White Rocket Entertainment. White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 266. And welcome to Open Wheel, the White Rocket Formula One and IndyCar podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and I'm joined by my hopefully regular co-host for this occasional program, Alan J. Porter. Welcome back aboard the show, Alan.
Thanks, Van. It's great to be back, and I look forward to doing a few more of these with you as the season progresses.
I hope so. Yeah, I don't know that we'll be a weekly show, but we certainly can check in from time to time and certainly discuss how things are going in Formula One and also in IndyCar, and just have a good conversation, hopefully entertain and enlighten the folks out there in the audience. This is my second season, so I'm still learning, I'm still gathering. One of my favorite things to do in life is to find some new thing to be interested in and then just soak up as much as I can about it as quickly as I can, and I've really been enjoying doing that over the last 12 months or so. But you have a much deeper and longer history with the sport, isn't that not correct?
That's true, and I'm actually just doing the math. God, it must be my, hang on a minute, I'm just trying to figure this out. 41st season of watching Formula on a regular basis, and I remember being aware of it and sort of half following it as a kid, but 1970, probably 75 or 76 was probably the first season I really got hooked with it and pretty much tried to watch almost every race since then.
Wow. Well, tell me this, I have watched, Rush, which I loved. Was that, I can't remember what year it was set in. Was that before your time?
That was 76. That was the first year that really hooked.
Wow.
Formula One.
How about that?
That was a good year for British motorsport. We had three world champions. We had James Hunt in Formula One, Barry Sheen in MotoGP. Not that it was called MotoGP back then, but in the motorcycle Grand Prix. Uh-huh. And then in another motorcycle sport called Speedway, which only really flourishes in Southern California in this country, but is huge in Europe and Australia. We had the world champion in that too. So it was a good motorsport year to for the UK 76.
What what is that last one like? What is it that's what is it like?
I once heard it described as a bar fight on motorcycles.
I'm so glad I asked. I'm so glad I asked.
We could do a whole podcast on that because that's actually my passion. My family's been involved with that sport since the early 1930s.
Holy cow.
Basically, it's four guys on motorcycles on a dirt track, flat dirt track in a stadium, and the bikes accelerate faster than a Formula One car. And they, up to about 60 mile an hour, they're actually faster than an F1 car. They have no brakes.
What?
Fixed gear. Yep. No gearbox, no brakes. they basically slide them elbow to elbow, bar to bar, around a 400-meter track for four laps. So each race lasts about a minute. And then a Grand Prix would have 20 races in it. And they also have teams. So I grew up supporting my local Speedway team. I still follow them, even though I'm thousands of miles away now. That team's been going for... It's 90th year next year. They've been racing, so it's got a long tradition. But it's huge in Europe, particularly in Poland and Sweden, and used to be big in the UK. Used to be the UK's second largest spectator sport behind soccer.
Wow!
Not so much these days, but long history. I could do a whole podcast on that.
I was going to say you've thrown out the terms bar fight and no brakes, and I'm just thinking people are all like going, "I've got to find out about this now." That just sounds...
Go on YouTube and just Google Speedway or British Speedway or something British like that. Yeah, you'll find some cool videos, clips.
It sounds like Death Race 2000 or something.
I will actually say, you wouldn't know it, but the current world champion is actually American, and he's been world champion four times, and he gets zero publicity in the U.S.
Yeah, I wouldn't have a clue. That's amazing. All right. Well, that's really neat. So you folks, so you listeners out there, you've already got a little bonus here, which is a whole other auto sport you can auto-ish or motorsport that you can check out that sounds utterly fascinating. And now I've got to find out about it. So, all right. Well, the last time we spoke, this show was called the White Rocket Formula One Show, but we've kind of expanded out because I wanted to include IndyCar too. IndyCar was my first love all the way back when I was a little tiny kid, watching Johnny Rutherford and Gordon Johncock and AJ Foyt and the Unsers drive around Indy. And I always loved IndyCar. I got to tell you, when I came back to it last year, I was pretty horrified by what they've done to the cars. So I'm not a big fan of the current configuration of the actual Indy cars. But we can talk about that when we get to our Indy car segment. But we've added that on. But of course, the bulk of this show will be Formula One. And it's been a really exciting season. So I kind of first wanted to fill in listeners as to what some of the major changes have been this year, because there have been quite a few, and kind of what your take on them is. Because, I mean, you know, anybody can go out and read the newspaper or whatever to get the gist, but I want to get kind of your informed take on what's good, what's bad, what's been effective, and what hasn't. So what would you say are like the two or three major changes and whether they're good or bad, Alan?
Well, obviously, the biggest changes this year in terms of the car is the complete rewriting of the regulations. So probably the most visual thing is the cars are now wider.
Mm-hmm.
So they're now up to I've forgotten the exact dimensions. But, yeah, they're slightly wider. They've got bigger tires.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a fixed front shape of front wing that rakes back, and the back wing is narrower and lower, but
it's a lot lower.
Yeah, so they look more aggressive. I mean, the cliche is they now look fast standing still. They certainly do. They also have bigger tires, more grip, and they actually have a bigger aerodynamic diffuser underneath, which gives them a slight more downforce at the back. The mandate was that the cars had to be 5 seconds a lap quicker than the last time the regulations were done, and I think they're pretty close to that. They are definitely looking quicker. They stay on full throttle for about 10% longer, so you need more powerful engines. The engines have to last longer, but they have to be more powerful, and that means later braking. And one of the things people were worried about was the fact that because they were on full throttle longer and they'd be braking later and reducing the braking zones, there'd be less overtaking. And because of the dependence on aerodynamics, they'd be harder for one car to follow the other.
Mm-hmm.
But the first three races don't seem to be following the logic of the physics.
No.
Because they've been cracking races with lots of overtaking.
Yes.
Because, you know, people were worried the cars being wider, you wouldn't get two. It'd be hard to get two cars side by side. Yet in Bahrain, we had them going into corners three wide.
Is it? So because
it's been interesting. You know, everybody was like, "Oh, yeah, they seem to have gone slightly the wrong way. Yeah, they look cool, but I don't think that you're going to get the overtaking." And it seems to be exactly the opposite so far. So it's been an interesting start to the season in terms of what the new cars can actually do.
Yeah, it seems like that the grip is making up for the change in the aerodynamics and everything. Is that somewhat accurate? Do I have any clue what I'm talking about?
No, it does, but it's interesting. You know, if you compare Mercedes and Ferrari, the two teams that have certainly seemed to have come out on top this mm-hmm. early in the season, they seem both to have grip in different ways. Mercedes is definitely looking very fast on a single lap or a couple of laps, and Lewis Hamilton, of course, seems to be able to get a series of quick laps out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But so it seems to have the grip to do that, while the Ferrari seems to be better on a longer run and manage its tires better. So they're able to keep the tires on longer or even run a compound softer than the Mercedes. So interesting to see that, you know, the increased grip has basically produced slightly different results in different teams. And then sort of you've got Red Bull, who are sort of hanging around in third. I haven't quite seemed to have got, if you'll pardon the pun, got to grip with what they want to do with the new formula yet.
Right.
So it'll be interesting as, you know, as the season goes on and people see what works and what doesn't in the other teams and they all start copying it, it'll start to sort of even out. But at the moment, there seems to be very different approaches as to how they've actually engineered these new cars.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's been really interesting to see how with different approaches and different things going on, the Mercedes and the Ferrari have ended up almost even. In fact, they've gone back and forth on wins and second places, and then of course, like you say, you've got the Red Bulls in third among the three constructors, which is about, I guess, where we expected. Really, what happened is that Ferrari just got better. Because it used to, last year it was Mercedes, Red Bull, Ferrari, more or less. And this year what's happened is that Ferrari has just come up competitive with Mercedes. Red Bull really hasn't gone down. They just kind of got left behind by Ferrari going up in some ways. And so the other problem that Red Bull seems to have is reliability. Of the six cars we just mentioned, they're the only ones that have had retirements. And they've had two of their six, one for Verstappen this past week, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and one for Ricciardo just having horrible problems at the beginning of the Australian race in the first week. So it's like Ferrari has gotten good enough that Red Bull has just kind of been left standing still. Is that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. And Red Bull have also, interestingly, pushed back against some of the aerodynamic changes, one of the things that was the gap in the new regulations, where everybody suddenly came out with this horrible shark fin on the back, and suddenly sprouted these T-shaped wings at the back. But everybody except Red Bull is running the T wings. Red Bull are still saying we're not going to run those, and are actually trying to get them banned. Right. So whether they got caught flat-footed on the gap in the regulations that the other folks saw, which would be really strange because they actually have the best car designer and aerodynamicist in their pit, in Adrian Newey. It is very interesting. And for once, Ferrari seemed to have the pace on the long runs, which, Ferrari in the past have tended to go for, the glory, if you like. Let's be fast on the single laps and get fastest laps and poles. And we're lucky if we win a race. But they seem to have gone more for the true and steady, let's make sure this car actually is reliable over a long distance type approach. And it seems to be paying dividends for them, which is great to watch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been a great season, absolutely. The three races in, it's been fantastic. So I want to talk about some of the other teams, because I would argue that where last year, it may have been that I wasn't as familiar last year, but last year pretty much everybody that wasn't the top three teams to me was just a big jumble of blah. Okay, whereas this year there's been almost a definite pecking order that seems to have fallen into place already among kind of the middle and the back. And I want to get into that, but first a couple more things about the top three. Talking about the T-wing, one reason that Red Bull's not happy about it, it's true they're not using it. And the shark fin, to me, the shark fin thing, it's where the back, for those who don't know, the back of the car has this wing that's vertical, like an airplane that sticks up, and it just looks... It throws the whole aesthetics of the car off. But anyway, at least to me. But the T-wing, everybody's doing these things differently, and Mercedes actually has an independently mounted T-wing, like standing up between a sort of a foreshortened angular shark fin and the back spoiler. And so Mercedes T-wing, because it stands up on its own, Valtteri Bottas has actually flown off twice. And I was going to say, one of the reasons Red Bull may want to get rid of it is that the last time it flew off, it supposedly did $75,000 worth of damage to the bottom of Max Verstappen's car. I looked at my wife and said, you could blow up all three of our cars and not do $75,000 of damage. One little piece of metal hits their car and does more damage than our entire household. So I could see where Red Bull wouldn't be too happy with it.
Yeah, I mean, they're going the safety angle, but, being cynical, they're also the only team that isn't running a T-wing.
Right.
But, yeah, there is the safety angle, though. I did hear the quote this morning on another podcast that the boss of Mercedes says we fixed it so well that you could take a baseball bat to it now and it wouldn't shift.
Yeah, I'll believe that when it doesn't. Yeah, they'll say that, and then it'll come flying off and, hit Ricciardo or something next time. So,
but you do make a point. It is very interesting that actually Mercedes have got the foreshortened shark fin and got that space between the end of the shark fin and the gearbox where they've mounted the independent T-wing. Well, a lot of the others, like Ferrari, have the full-length shark fin and have actually put the planes of the T-wing across the top of that. So, yeah, it's, again, an interesting different take on the aerodynamics and how they're actually interpreting the regulations and the way that the air is now flowing around these cars because nobody has any real data. They don't have seasons worth of data to call back on now. So, you know, a lot of this is stuff that looks good in the wind tunnel, and then let's go try it out on track and see if it actually works.
Right. Well, while we're still talking about the top three for a second, it's funny. We've got the two guys that really seem to have their cars dialed in and they know what they're doing, and Sebastian Vettel and Lewis Hamilton, and they've traded off wins back and forth. But then you have the other two, and I'm more interested about the interested in the other two because they don't have it going on. And it's been really interesting because Valtteri Bottas was saying in the last race that he is, quote, rear limited, unquote. And this something to do with tire inflation issues on his Mercedes. And then the Ferrari, obviously, Kimi Raikkonen doesn't say much, but most of what he says is, it's not working right, it's not giving me any power, the wheels are terrible, you know, it's just nothing but this isn't working, this isn't working. So talk a little bit about Bottas and Raikkonen and what the heck's going on, why they are getting left behind by their two teammates.
Well, I think the other two, Vettel and Hamilton, have definitely set their stalls out to be, you know, I'm the number one driver in the team. Very early in the season. So, you know, in terms of Mercedes, where is that going to lead to? I think we saw that at the end of Bahrain Grand Prix, where basically Bottas was told to move over for Hamilton and let him pass, and he was a very nice boy and did so. I expect to see a lot more of that. I mean, Bottas has always been quick in qualifying. He was quick in the Williams. He was good at qualifying the Williams when he was there. I expected him to have good qualifying performances. The pole position was great to see. He did actually outdrive Hamilton on that qualifying at Bahrain, which was great. But I don't think he has yet that full level of racecraft to really run right at the front with the likes of Vettel and Hamilton. I think we saw that when he spun behind the safety car. He didn't sort of charge his way back through the pack as quickly as somebody in a Mercedes probably should have done.
Or Verstappen.
The tire thing's interesting. It's interesting that this early in the season we're actually seeing Mercedes make mistakes that they never would have done in the past, small mistakes. I mean, like overinflating the tires. so that his first stint in the last Grand Prix, Bottas had overinflated rear tires, which means that, you know, one, they're going to be harder and not going to get grip, but they're also going to overheat and go off quicker. He talked a lot about being rear limited. Basically that, you know, he couldn't really get the rear tires to bed in and grip and give him the performance that he wanted. You hear the phrase, you know, something limited, pretty much. It seems to be the phrase of the year at the moment in Formula One from the drivers. I think in China it was, you know, we're left front limited because that's the tire that takes most of the load. So that's the one that you have to get to work the best. And if they can't, it'll be, oh, you know, I'm left front limited, or I'm right rear limited, or I'm whatever. Obviously Bottas is not getting the car to work as well as Hamilton. As far as Raikkonen's concerned, the man's an enigma. I mean, this is an ex-world champion. On his day, he's fantastic, but his day is, I think, he's well past. He seems to be settling into whatever position he's in by the end of lap two. I'm just going to stay here all day. I think he did that, the move on Massa in Bahrain. But once he got past Massa, it's like, okay, I'm just going to settle into this position. He doesn't really seem to be looking for overtaking opportunities. He's sort of following people through corners, but he's not being aggressive. He's not sort of taking different lines like Vettel is. I think he's riding out his contract. That's just my personal opinion, but that's what it's looking like from outside. He's still a good driver, and like I say, he can have flashes of brilliance, but we're just not seeing it this year. He's not the Kimi of old. So I think he's pretty much settled into, I'm going to be the number two and let Vettel go for it. I don't think he's going to be back next year at all. Like I say, the guy's an enigma. The complaining on the radio, I think it was China, where he was doing a lot of complaining about he wasn't getting the right power. But I read somewhere that he actually had forgotten to switch the car from rain mode to dry mode. So part of the reason he was complaining was because he actually hadn't flicked the switch to change the engine mapping. but again, that's just sort of hearsay. yeah, he does seem to be doing a lot of complaining at the moment, which again is very unusual. You probably weren't watching Formula One back then, but several years ago when he was driving for Lotus, there was a famous moment when the engineers came on and kept talking to him, and he basically turned around over the radio and said, "Leave me alone, I know what I'm doing." Which became a standard T-shirt that you see a lot of F1 races, is the Kimi quote of "Leave me alone, I know what I'm doing." And at the moment, it doesn't look like he knows what he's doing, right, other than driving around and cashing the salary check.
Didn't Verstappen say something similar to that last week? Something like, "I need you to stop talking now," or something like that?
Yeah. It was right at the end, towards the end of the race, when he was in a battle, and the engineers kept talking to him, and he was like, "Yeah, shut up. Don't talk to me right now."
I love
him.
Which,
you know, if he's concentrating, I can totally understand. You don't want the engineer chattering away in your ear when you're in the middle of a battle and focused on what you're trying to do. So.
Right. Tell me this. Is it that the Mercedes cars right now in general are still the best cars, and that a combination of Mercedes making some mistakes plus Sebastian Vettel just being good and having a car that's almost as good is why Vettel is ahead right now? Or is Ferrari dead even with Mercedes? What do you think?
Like I said earlier, I think they're both the best car at two different things.
Right.
I think the Mercedes is the best car at outright speed, plus the fact they have the capability to turn the engine power up slightly if they need to at various points. They just have a little gizmo they can get a bit more power as and when they need it. And I think the Ferrari is the better car at handling the tires, working better with the tires and working better on a longer run. And I think also Vettel is using that to his advantage. Mm-hmm. He is driving the car slightly differently. I don't know if you noticed in China when he did those two great moves, overtaking moves at turn six. But if you sort of watch the replay, he was setting up those from like turn one. He was actually, instead of following the car he wanted to overtake through turn one, he was actually pulling out slightly and getting into cleaner air to get more downforce on the wings, which sort of gave him more grip and more momentum. Mm. So by the time he got to turn six, he actually had the momentum to go around the outside, which was very cool to see. So I think he's figured the car out and the way the car handles and what its strengths are, and making it look good. But I actually also think it's a very good car on the long run. So I would say that they're pretty much even overall. Yeah,
that's interesting. That's cool, Vidi. I like that. I like when they bring all kinds of different strategy and neat ideas into it, besides just, you know, going faster. You know, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I got to say this about Bottas. You mentioned about how his role in the team seems to be, and it just eats me up. I was trying really hard. Okay, I don't want to alienate anybody out there. I was trying really hard, now that my boy Nico Rosberg is done and is watching on TV on his coffee table in his apartment in Monaco. I was trying really hard to not dislike Lewis Hamilton. And then Lewis Hamilton just went and just ticked me off again by, you know, somebody – what was it? Somebody asked him a question like I forget exactly what the question was, but his answer was, I've raced against Nico Rosberg all my life. He beat me once. Like something like, do you miss the challenge, or do you miss the rivalry, or whatever? He's like, oh, that was it. He said, do you miss the rivalry with Rosberg? He said, rivalry? There was no rivalry. I raced him my whole life, and he beat me once. And I'm just like, you arrogant so-and-so. I'm done with you. I gave you a chance, and you've already messed it up. But this, the thing is, he seems to love Valtteri Bottas, because Bottas seems very subservient or whatever you want to say the right word is, and just kind of gets out of his way and doesn't challenge him the way Rosberg does. And then the driver that is challenging him, Vettel, is on a different team, so I guess that's okay too. It just feels to me like a double standard, that Hamilton can love Vettel and love Bottas, but just seem to hate Nico Rosberg. Do you have any thoughts about that, or is this just my own personal little emotional thing?
No, I sort of see where you're coming from. I mean, my understanding is the two of them were actually great friends for most of the time that they raced together up until a couple of years ago, until basically they got in the same F1 team. They used to be on the same karting team,
yeah.
Hamilton and Rosberg, and they did grow up together. And statistically, Hamilton's right. You know, Rosberg only did beat him in one championship, and that was last year. So I think I said this on the last podcast. To be a Formula One world champion, particularly a multi-world champion, you've got to be arrogant. You've got to believe in yourself. You've got to have that killer instinct. All the great multi-time champions are not come across on occasions as not necessarily being the nicest person in the room. Mm. I've actually been impressed by Hamilton being a bit more mature this year, particularly with the 5-second penalty in Bahrain.
That's true.
You know, when they interviewed him after the race, and he was like, "Yeah, it was just one of those things. It was my fault." Mm. And I actually don't think I think it was a consequence of the team making a wrong decision that ended up stacking the pit stops,
right.
So he had to slow down coming into pit lane.
Right.
And he didn't, you know, he didn't have a tantrum and blame the team, which he would have done in the past. He didn't, you know, he wasn't sulking on the podium, which he would have done in the past. At China when they, the practice was rained off and he was the only driver who went out and mingled with the crowd and,
yep.
you know, made sure the crowd was entertained. And yep. in fact, I don't, you know, in China, he'd learned a few words of Chinese to say thank you to the crowd when he was on the podium and stuff like that. So yeah, I think he's matured now. He's away from the Rosberg rivalry, or seems to have done. And he and Vettel, I think there's always been the opportunity there for the two of them to go head-to-head, but it's never really happened. When Vettel's been in a dominant car, Lewis hasn't. When Lewis has been in a dominant car, Vettel hasn't. Now the two of them are in almost identical equipment. And at the moment, there actually seems to be, if not a liking between the two of them, they at least seem to be aware of each other's capabilities and respect that.
Right.
It'll be interesting as the season goes on and things become more and more tense as to how long that stays. But at this stage of the season, yes, I think he's actually relishing a fight with somebody else that isn't his teammate.
Yeah, that's fair. I will give him this. I do think that he's been I think he's easily the best with the crowd. He's very good at playing the crowd. You know, going out, he's like a NASCAR driver in that he instinctively knows to thank the public, thank his sponsors, thank his team, in ways that it very instantly that most of the other drivers seem to kind of like have to stop and think about it or be reminded of it or something. But he always is very personable with the crowd and all that. I will give him that.
By the way, you're not on your own. My wife can't stand him either.
Well, I think I wanted to like him. I've tried to give him a chance. He just isn't letting me. Let's see. I want to kind of look down some of the other teams. And when we get down to McLaren, we can talk about Fernando Alonso,
oh, yeah.
Obviously. Some big news there. But so Red Bull just needs to find some reliability. And I guess they're getting new engines soon. Is that what I understand? Renault is sending them some new engines once we get to Spain or something?
Spain will be – well, all of these first four races are all flyaway races. I mean, they're away from base, so you know, getting parts out there is expensive and difficult. I think that all the teams are looking at the race in Spain and Barcelona, where they're actually all going to bring most of their major updates. So I think we'll see new engines probably and engine updates, and I think we'll see quite a bit of body work and aerodynamic updates in Spain, all across the grid. So I know some of the lower teams are not doing any development while they're on the flyaway races and are basically looking to Spain to actually be their next big development step. I did see photos and stuff of Red Bull mechanics flying out to Bahrain with literally crates full of carry-ons and stuff that they were taking parts out there. I think they had a new front wing. I think they are doing little bits during these flyaway races, but yeah, I think when we get to Barcelona, you're going to see virtually every team have some major updates.
I did see, by the way, that the Red Bull cars, and not even Toro Rosso, but just the Red Bull cars, had this little secret air scoop on the nose that nobody else had. Did you see that?
Yeah, they all had it a few seasons ago, but okay. They seem to be the only ones that have put it back in. Yeah.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. I just think it's neat when these cars they look kind of the same at first glance, but when you really start studying them, they're each doing a little bit differently, and that's interesting because then it's not all just the same. You know, you start getting little tweaks here and there, and that's kind of cool. So, yeah, we just got to get some reliability out of Red Bull because that's my team this year, and I'm really kind of wanting to see. I just really like Max Verstappen. I mean, I know he's kind of a pain in the butt sometimes, but, man, you know that when it's wet or when he's starting at the back of the pack, it's going to be fun.
I think they should just give him a 10-place grid penalty every race.
Well, he'll pass nine of them as soon as he starts. That's the thing. He passes so many. They're all just starting to get moving, and he's like, "Excuse me, pardon me, get right." I'm just going right through the pack.
Have you seen that onboard video of his first lap in China?
Oh yeah,
he went from what 18th to 7th in one lap.
In one lap.
Yeah.
And then
it's crazy. I mean, he just seems to find grip and spaces where nobody else is mm-hmm. even looking for it.
It's true. It's true.
Yeah. He just seems to be able to, they used to say about Dale Earnhardt, he used to be able to see the air.
Yeah.
And Max seems to be pretty much the same. He just seems to be able to read where the gaps are going to be, where the grip's going to be, and put his car into position and just take advantage of it. Yeah, I think himself, Hamilton and Vettel are the three that really, and Alonso, the four that really push the limits on where you can overtake and you know, take innovative approaches to corners and plan their overtaking and seem to make it effortless when other people really struggle. But yeah, Max is a joy to watch.
He really
particularly
is.
When he's at the back. Yeah. I was really disappointed in Bahrain that he went out.
I was so sad. I know, not just because I was cheering for him, but because it would have been more interesting to have him in the mix.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think he was on track for a podium there.
It seemed like it. One more Red Bull question for you. Daniel Ricciardo, and again, I'm just kind of absorbing and catching up on all the history and everything. I get the sense that like 2-3 years ago, he was the next big thing. Is he ever going to win anything, or is it passed him by already?
No, I mean, he's won a few Grand Prix. There's been a few that he should have won. Monaco last year being prime example, when his pit crew messed up his tire change and lost in the race. I mean, I think he's good for several races. I don't know whether he's got world championship potential in him. Again, I think he's maybe a bit too nice, a bit too much fun to win a world championship. A bit like Mark Webber before him, who was a great Australian driver, good fun to watch, could do some spectacular things. Was a good fighter, but never really grasped the world title. I think Ricciardo may be the same. I mean, I know last year a lot of the F1 journalists actually rated Ricciardo as the best driver of the year last year. I don't think I quite agreed with that. I think he's certainly, you know, top four, top five, maybe. Yeah, top four driver. It'll be interesting to see, you know, as you said, he had the huge disappointment in Australia, never really even got to start his home Grand Prix.
Yeah, that was terrible.
Been okay. I mean, the fight he had with Vettel in China was great. When the two of them literally banged wheels and turned
six, yeah,
rubbed the Pirelli decals off the side of their tires.
yeah, they did.
You know, whatever it was, close to 200 miles an hour was amazing to watch. He's a good racer. The other guys know how to race him hard. He races hard. He's difficult to overtake. Again, I don't think he's quite got that killer instinct that will take him to a world championship. But I'd like to be proved wrong one year.
Well,
I don't think it'll be this year.
And that's what I've been kind of sensing, right? I mean, I'm just saying that it felt like he was the next Vettel or the next Hamilton for a minute, and then it's like, well, wait, no, Verstappen's even better than you. It's going to be Verstappen if it's either one of you. And, you know, it just seemed like he's gotten relegated into like the second guy on his team almost already, even though he's, not old at all.
It's very analogous with what happened at Red Bull when Webber was there and Vettel came into the team. It's almost an identical situation.
Yeah. Let's see. Let's go on down through some of the teams. I don't have, let me see if I've got the team standings. I've got the driver standings, but, okay. So Ferrari, Mercedes are very close right now, and Red Bull. Force India, are they actually in fourth? Yeah, they are in fourth place right now.
Yeah, they're in fourth place right now. Yeah.
These are the cars that are now pink.
Yeah, yeah.
I like it.
So, yeah, I like the color. They need a better graphic designer. It's a nice color, but it just looks like they've just thrown stickers at a three-year-old, throw stickers at it. Yeah, it's a great color. I mean, they're really – their key is that basically both their guys are finishing in the points each race.
That's it.
Chico Perez, is another one who is, you know, doing some great drives and doing a lot of overtaking and getting the cars up there. And Ocon, was going to say teenager, but he's not, he's 20. But another young guy who seems to have come in and, you know, got a lot of ability and not be overwhelmed in terms of getting in among the big guys and getting into point scoring positions. So, they are consistently scoring points, which is what you need to be doing.
Well, the interesting thing about Force India is it looks like they are the only team other than Ferrari and Mercedes at the top that have had both drivers finish, not just finish in the points, which they have, but finish, period, every race.
Yep.
Every other team has retired at least one car, if not two.
Yeah.
That'll do it. That'll put you up there, even though you're not really dominating, because others have had higher finishes, but just not consistently all the way across the board like that.
Exactly, yeah. So, respect to them, they, you know, compared to other teams, they've got a relatively low budget.
Mm-hmm.
But they invest in drivers. They don't necessarily pay drivers. They invest in their future. They take evolutionary design steps. They don't really try anything revolutionary. I was going to say slow and steady wins the race, but they're not that slow. But you get the point. Is basically by being there, having both drivers there at the end of the day, is they're picking up the points.
Yeah. Next up is Williams. If they're listed as Williams Mercedes, I think them as Williams Martini. Is that just their sponsor or something? Is that what I'm?
Yeah, Martini's their prime sponsor. Yeah,
okay.
They have a Mercedes engine. Yeah.
What is Martini other than a drink that James Bond likes?
It's a brand. It's a vermouth brand, Italian vermouth brand.
Oh, okay.
They have a long, long history of being a motorsports sponsor.
So it actually is related to martinis.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I figured it's like a watch or something. Just happened to have that name. Cool.
No. It's a vermouth.
Oh, I'm in. Awesome. Very good.
Yeah, it's pretty good actually. Williams are the exact opposite of Force India, where they've got one guy who is finishing in the points and high up in the points, the unretired Felipe Massa.
Yep.
And then you've got the other guy who, in two out of three incidences, through no fault of his own, has failed to finish a single race, so it hasn't scored any points. So, you know, in terms of on-track performance, Williams should be really ahead of Force India, but, if you've only got one guy finishing in the points, then it's going to hamper you. And then, like I said, poor Lance Stroll has been the victim of circumstances no more than, spectacularly on Sunday with the bonehead move from Carlos Sainz that took him out when Sainz T-boned him coming out of the pits. You got to feel sorry for Lance Stroll. He's under a lot of pressure. He seems to be qualifying well, but he's had a mechanical and two incidences which were not his fault. So,
well, that's impressed me is that the Williams cars seem to be very good this year. They're not. I mean, they're not quite Mercedes or Ferrari caliber, but they seem to be hanging in there pretty darn well. I mean, when they're not getting crashed, they seem to be legitimate upper middle level cars.
Yeah, I think they're a definite, the mid pack fight is always for fourth place, and Williams is definitely a contender for fourth place if they can start getting the consistency with both drivers finishing. I think between Force India, Williams, Toro Rosso, and Haas and Renault, those guys are all clumped together very tightly.
Yes,
in terms of performance. So.
Yeah, the. It's funny. Somebody was pointing out, I thought this was funny, that they were pointing out that, is it Pascal Wehrlein that's only driven in one race so far this year?
Yeah.
He's actually completed more laps than Lance Stroll has in three races.
Yep. Well, Lance Stroll hasn't done any. So, I think Lance Stroll has done one, hasn't he?
Just ridiculous.
Yeah,
Let's see. So Toro Rosso, I was going to say that as far as the cars looks, I love the Williams, the white, that clean white with the pinstripes. I think it looks really good, especially on the new shape of the car. And I like Toro Rosso. Toro Rosso basically looks like a can of Red Bull with wheels. They've just gone to kind of that silver and blue, not so much orange and yellow as the Red Bulls have. And they're doing pretty darn well too, huh?
Yeah, I think I think the Toro Rosso is probably the nicest looking of the 2017 cars.
Hmm.
They're the only one that has a gloss finish. You've noticed that all the others are matte.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Because apparently matte is meant to be better for the aerodynamics, but Toro Rosso went, oh, hell, let's make it look like a can of Red Bull, and they put a gloss varnish on it, and it looks really good.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, they seem to be doing well. Danny Kvyat is, you know, doing what he should be doing. He's doing good journeyman, middle of the thing. Sainz, again, is another enigma. The guy that can be incredibly fast, he makes some really interesting choices, like in China being the only guy to start the wet race on slicks. I saw an interview with him that basically said, yeah, I know I'll be last at the end of the first lap, but I reckon I'll be sixth by lap 10. and he wasn't far out. Yeah, he spun on the first lap and ended up last, and I think he was like got up to sixth by about lap 7 or 8. didn't manage to keep it up there, but it was a brave and interesting strategic move. And if the track had dried sooner, he probably would have made more of it. And then he did that in China, and then a week later in Bahrain, he makes that boneheaded move of T-boning Stoll, which was, you know, the more I watched the replay, the less I could believe it.
Yeah.
He could see the guy was in front of him and was turning into the corner, and yeah. I think the official reprimand said he made an over-optimistic attempt.
I love the use of optimistic in something like that.
Yeah.
It looked like he had the same problem that Verstappen did, where his brakes just went out and he was traveling in a straight line until he hit something. Did you see when Verstappen's, apparently his brakes failed? And I love how he's just driving along and he goes off the track and he's on the gravel and he's just going along. And you're like, okay, stop. Okay, stop. You're going like 5 miles an hour, stop, and then bam, hits the wall.
Yeah.
So maybe he should have said, brake failure, can't turn, can't steer, can't stop, look out, bam.
Yeah.
The Haas boys are hanging in there. I don't have a lot to say about them. Any thoughts on the Haas team? They seem to be all right.
Yeah, they do. I mean, the thing is, last year their first year they started out with a real bang, getting like 6th in the first race and were right up there. I think where they are now is probably more their natural position for their second year.
Mm-hmm.
They still seem to be suffering with the brake problem they had at the end of last season.
Yeah.
So I was seeing in the testing that they did this week in Bahrain after the race, they did a week of testing, that they were actually switching brake suppliers for the test to see if they could solve their braking problem. So, but having said that, Romain Grosjean's done, you know, some good qualifying. Efforts and been scoring points for them. Kevin Magnussen is a bit hit and miss. he seems to have, you know, also be getting any of the bad luck that's in the team. It all seems to be heading Magnussen's way at the moment.
Yeah.
And again, reliability, as you said, it's early in the season with these new cars. I think they're still quite fragile. So.
Well, two more. Sauber.
Three more.
Yeah, I know. I'm almost ruling one out. Renault. I'm very intrigued by Renault. I didn't think anything about them. I barely even knew they existed last season. This season, though, I realize they're all the way down in 8th, but they've only had one retirement, and they've been finishing, what, 11, 12, 13, 13, 9, somewhere in there. But they seem to have potential. I mean, I believe that Hülkenberg actually qualified 7th in Bahrain, right? So...
Palmer qualified 10th. It was the first time they've had both cars in the top three in qualifying. Yeah.
So they didn't finish as great, but it just seems like they seem like one to watch.
Yeah. I mean, Hülkenberg's a great driver. You know, he's a past Le Mans sports car 24-hour race winner. So he's, you know, he's no slouch behind the wheel, and he brings a lot, and he's driven for quite a few of the other teams. So I think he brings a lot of knowledge to the team this year in terms of setting up the car, having come from some of the more front-running teams, I think he can help them with that. And they are rebuilding. I mean, basically, 2016 was their first.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, they were Lotus. They were branded as Lotus team, but they went through a lot of financial issues and really went down to really skeleton staff. So 2016 was really them rebuilding, and they've sort of been. Employing more people, recruiting more people, rebuilding the factory and rebuilding the team. And, you know, I think Renault Now they've got a major manufacturer behind them. You know, Renault, when they've done Formula One in the past as a works team, they've always put a lot of effort into it, a lot of R&D into it, and ended up pretty near the front. So I would be prepared to watch them over the next couple of seasons, and don't be surprised if Fernando Alonso is in a Renault next year.
Ooh, interesting. If they're a better, if they're a more competitive car and have a more competitive driver in there, wow. That would be great. Yeah. I'm ready to cheer for Renault. I'm ready. I'm not cheering for him right now, but I've got one eye on him, and I'm ready to jump on the bandwagon if the bandwagon cranks up.
No, they have the worst driver uniforms in the history of the sport.
The yellow and black.
Yeah, they look like they're both wearing waders and are going fishing in some river somewhere.
Yeah, I do like the colors on the car, though. I think it's a neat combination on the car.
Yeah, the yellow and black looks really good. I mean, the car looked really good at the launch. Yeah, it's just those team uniforms are terrible.
Yeah, they need to redesign that. The color, it's not the color so much as how they got them blocked out like that. I agree. It's pretty heinous.
Julian Palmer, I think, has flashes, but I think he's a little inconsistent. It wouldn't surprise me that, if he's gone at the end of the season and Alonso is in there with Hülkenberg next year, and that would be an interesting driver lineup.
Yes, it would. That would be very cool. The last two, Sauber, the little blue and white cars, they just seem hapless to me. I don't have really any interest in them. Is there any reason I should care at all about Sauber?
Oh, yeah, they're the little engine that could.
Okay.
I mean, they went through a change of team ownership a couple of seasons ago. They seem to have sponsorship this year. They're still pretty much running on a shoestring. The car was pretty quick. I mean, Australia, well, quick for a bat marker. I mean, they had the interesting thing at the beginning of the year where Wöhrlein turned up in Australia and then said, oh, I'm not fit enough to actually race these cars.
Yeah.
And the third driver, who's actually Ferrari's third driver, Antonio Giovinazzi, stepped in with like an hour's running and then put in a really good qualifying lap and actually was doing really well in the race. I can't quite remember where he finished in the race. He finished in 12th. So he was, you know, two places away from scoring their points.
Mm-hmm.
So everything was looking pretty good. And then...
And then
China, he got out of Q1 into Q2 and then stuffed the car into the barrier so he couldn't do his Q2 run. And then in the race itself, he stuffed the car in the barrier yet again at exactly the same spot. They're not a team that can afford to be rebuilding two cars in general, and rebuilding two cars during an away race is even less. So I think that probably hit them. So it was interesting to see Wöhrlein back in the car. Now he's totally fit. He ran, what did he finish? He ran, I'm just looking at
11.
Yeah, he finished 13th. So, they got to the end of the race, which is more than McLaren did. they may not have scored any points, but they're doing better than McLaren. The other guy, Ericsson, I think he's out of his depth. Says the guy who's never driven a Formula One car in his life. He just doesn't look to be the right guy in the right place at the moment.
No, he doesn't.
I don't think he's really got the talent to be running the F1.
I was going to say, I think Giovinazzi, he had the worst experience with China since the U.S. got too close to the Yalu River in 1950.
I feel sorry for him. I actually wish they had taken Ericsson out of the car in Bahrain and put Giovinazzi in the back in the other one alongside Wöhrlein. That would have been an interesting combination.
Yeah.
Because the guys, you know, now the last thing everybody remembers about him is not the great job he did in Australia. What everybody remembers is him crashing, those two crashes in China, and that's basically, you know, you're only as good as your last race, and if that's your last race, then unless something spectacular happens, he may have just killed his Formula One career, which would be a shame because I actually think he's got talent.
Well, I was just imagining the team principal of Sauber going to him and saying, dude, we've only got two cars, okay? you can't do that. Yeah. If you have to drive 20 miles an hour like Granny around the track, don't wreck our last two cars. And he wrecked the last two cars. So,
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, modern Formula One, they only actually do have two cars. Even Ferrari and Mercedes, they only have two cars. You're only allowed to have one car for each driver built, and you can bring spares to repair.
Right.
It used to be like you were talking about Rush earlier, if you watched that movie and stuff, where people would sometimes a team would take a complete spare car, a T car, a third car, that they could set up for either of the drivers that they could use as if they crashed or there was a mechanical problem, and they could jump in and out of the T car. But you can't do that under the rules anymore. You actually can only have one car per driver plus a bunch of spares. So whether you're Sauber or Ferrari, that same rule applies.
That is interesting. And meanwhile, over in Formula E, they actually like park a car, jump in another car, and take off driving again, which is the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. I just think that's hilarious. They actually park and change cars during the race. I'm just flabbergasted by that. Well, we got one left to go to squeeze in, and then we'll talk a little about the races real quick. McLaren, what is the deal? I mean, are they just not getting it? What have they got, technical issues? It's the Honda power plants, is that correct? It's weird that Honda is having horrible times with McLaren at the same time that they really seem to be doing pretty well over in Indy.
Yeah, well, it's a completely different engine for a
start. Right, I know that, but I just mean it seems like if you could figure out how to make one engine, you could figure out how to make the other one.
Yeah, it's... I don't know. If I knew what was wrong with McLaren, I wouldn't be in my current day job. I'd be over in Woking. I mean, it really hurts me. The Classic Lotus team is always my team. McLaren was probably my second team. And to see the once mighty team of McLaren down at the bottom scoring 0 points after three races is pretty unbelievable. I think it's a combination of the engine. But some of the retirements in the first two races were not engine related. They were things like drive shafts, and they were mechanical. The car as a whole is a holistic thing. So, right. You know, if one part's not working correctly, it can stress other parts. And I don't know. It's really strange what's going on with McLaren. Everybody seems totally confused and embarrassed by it. It may be, like some of the teams in the past, like Lotus and Brabham and some of the other teams, Tyrrell, and that you thought would always be around and just gradually faded away and dropped out of the sport. Maybe it's just natural selection and McLaren will be gone in a couple of years. I hope not. I hope they'll find out what the problem is, and we'll see them back at the sharp end at some point. But at the moment, it's other than the fact they have that nice orange on the car,
I do like that.
They have Alonso, and they have Alonso driving for them. I mean, Alonso is driving that car. You know, I mean, he's really flattering to deceive by getting that car up to be running sort of between 10th and 15th in most of the races, and duking it out. He is way over driving that car. He's driving it well beyond his capabilities. I liked his comment in Bahrain that he was amazed. The difference in power on the straight is incredible. And he wasn't saying that in a positive way. He was saying it, he got to the straight and all the other guys went sailing past him. So he's certainly making sure that everybody knows it's not him, it's the car. I'm driving like an animal was one in China, I think was his comment. And, it's the hardest race I've ever run and stuff. So he's making sure that we all know he has the talent and it's not him, it's the car.
He's making sure that we know that. That's right.
Yeah. But it is really sad to see McLaren floundering away at the bottom like this. Of all the stuff I've read and the other podcasts I've listened to and the journalists and the TV stuff and nobody seems to have a clue what's going on at McLaren. And they're a bunch of really smart guys. So you've got to wonder what on earth is the actual underlying cause of the problem.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure I've seen him get out and push a couple of times. At least I feel like I saw that. And also it seems like they've gone with the Flintstone style car where he's actually moving his feet underneath to make it go. So maybe they should try a different approach on locomotion than that. But now that we got the bottom and poor Alonso at the bottom, he's going to be racing in the Indianapolis 500. I'm so excited. Do you see that as a net positive? Are you excited too?
Yeah, I think it's awesome. I think it was great news. Took me totally by surprise, like it did most other people. Alonso is one of the best drivers out there. He is also a racer's racer, and I think he realizes he's never going to beat Michael Schumacher's 7 times world champion record. And I think he's beginning to wonder whether he'll ever see a third world championship. So he's pretty much said it over the years that, you know, he wants to do the Triple Crown. He wants to do Monaco, Indy, and Le Mans. Only right. one person has ever done that in history. It was won those three races. And he, you know, it's like, if I can't get the most Formula One world championships, I'm going to go do that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, reading the interviews, I think it started as a throwaway remark and a joke. I'd like to do, you know, Indy. Mm-hmm. And if you're McLaren and you want to do whatever you can to keep your top driver in place, when you're having a horrible season.
Okay.
And he says, I want to go do this. You go make it happen. And particularly if you actually have the connections, which they did. So, right. I think it's great. We've already made the decision not to go to Indy this year, having been last year. But I would have loved to have been at the Brit Yard and see Alonso there. I think it's a great thing for Formula One. I think it's a great thing for IndyCar. And I think it's a great thing for F1 in America. I think it will actually raise the profile of F1 in the States. And hopefully as a result of that, we'll see a few more people at COTA in October for the US Grand Prix, as well as maybe a few Formula One fans actually starting to watch IndyCar.
That's what I was thinking. Is that I keep hearing people say, "Oh, it'll be great for Formula One in the United States." I'm like, "Well, it may also be good for IndyCar everywhere else." Possibly.
Yeah,
I mean,
I think so.
People will be tuning in to Indy that they wouldn't have been otherwise. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it'll like quite have the impact as like when Nigel Mansell came over in '93, and basically IndyCar was almost rivaling Formula One worldwide in terms of its viewership because of Mansell being in it, because Mansell came over as the reigning world champion. Mm-hmm. But even to have you know, Alonso do the one-off, and I'm hoping he's with a good team, Andretti Autosport. Mm-hmm. Their results in the last race notwithstanding, but they normally know how to run a good multi-car team. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see how he goes. Hopefully, he'll get some practice or something up front to get himself acclimatized to the ovals. I've seen a few comments that, you know, he's underestimating how difficult Indy is going to be. I don't think so. I think he's an intelligent guy. He knows, but he's also a fan of the sport, and he has an understanding of the history of the sport. I think he'll know who to talk to, and he'll know, you know, how to get up to speed as quickly as possible and as safely as possible. I'm hoping he'll win. It's unusual for a rookie to win first time at Indianapolis, but, you know, Rossi did it last year.
Exactly. Yeah, so and coming from Formula One.
And coming from Formula One, and I did read that Montoya is actually basically going to coach Alonso. So that would be. I would love to be a fly on the wall in those discussions. So yeah, it'd be interesting to. And of course, Montoya won Indy in his rookie year too. So it'll be good to see Alonso at the Brit Yard, and I think it'll be great for both F1 and for IndyCar. Yeah, I think it's a win-win. And actually also to see Jenson Button back in a race car at Monaco this year, standing in for Alonso, will be great too.
So, that's awesome.
Because I'm a huge Jenson Button fan. I can get my Jenson Button baseball hat out of retirement for that
Yay!
Weekend.
So. That's cool. Let me pause for just a second. We got to thank our patrons who keep our shows on the air. And we always want to thank Nicholas Cottrell, as well as Dave Medinas, Mark Squire, Dave Powell, Jared Albrick, Michael Kirshner, Bill Matthews, and Joey Miller. You guys keep us going. We appreciate your contributions to the White Rocket family of entertainment programming and books and so forth. By the way, Alan, I'm going to miss you. I'll be up at the as a fellow writer, I'm going to be up at Windy City Pulp and Paper Convention tomorrow, which is Friday as we record this on Thursday night. That's the kind of the show I always feel like I should see you at, but I'm not sure you've ever come to it.
I actually have. I've been there the last 3 years.
You did? Did I see you last year and just don't remember it? Or was it last year or 2 years ago?
I think it was the year before.
Okay,
yeah,
I did.
But,
that's right.
No, I usually go on the Sunday because it's the same that's weekend right. as C2E2, the big mm-hmm. comics convention in Chicago.
Yeah.
So I used to do Friday, Saturday at C2E2 and then Sunday at Windy City. But since I have moved from the Sunshine State of Illinois down to Texas, it's a little bit further to travel. So
right.
Yeah, I won't be doing it this year.
Okay.
But it's a great show. I'll miss being there and at C2E2. Both very good shows.
Yeah, I'll be zipping up there tomorrow and probably just be there Friday and part of Saturday. But if anybody out there, I guess if I get this up fast enough, come on out to Lombard, Illinois, outside of Chicago, and check it out. It's cool pulp and classic and literature type convention. Let's see, the last thing I want to look at, I mean, I do want to mention a couple things about IndyCar, but last thing I want to look at with Formula One, we've had three races so far. We've talked a good bit about how it all played out already, so I don't think there's a whole lot left to do, but any other observations about Australia in terms of how things played out? You had Sebastian Vettel kind of surprise everybody by winning right out of the gate. And you had the two Mercedes, in second and third in that race. The Red Bulls, that was the one where Ricciardo had a hard time getting going. Verstappen ended up, finishing fifth. So anything about Australia stand out as noteworthy besides what we've already talked about?
The thing is with Australia, it's a temporary circuit in a park. So, you know, it's tight. It's not a real lot of runoff area, not a great area for overtaking, you would have thought, but there was actually quite a bit of overtaking. And it was a good start to the season. It was an incident pack race. It's always interesting because it's like you say, nobody really knows, you know, where the cars are going to be, how it's going to play out. I suppose the standout for me actually in Australia was the Toro Rosso team, who were the you know, both got their cars up in eighth and ninth place, so that, you know, they did a good job, a really great start. The heartbreak was obviously Daniel Ricciardo. You know, his home Grand Prix, and he had all that problems and really was late starting. I think he was like he was sat in the pits for the first three laps, was it? And then when he did get out, he actually ended up with a fuel pressure problem. Probably 20 laps in. So yeah, it was disappointing. I have a soft spot in my heart for Melbourne. I was actually lucky enough to be in Melbourne a couple of years ago on a business trip. Unfortunately, not Grand Prix weekend, but the weekend after. So the track was actually still in position. They actually hadn't dismantled anything yet. So I actually got to spend a day walking the Melbourne F1 racetrack.
Neat.
And once you've actually walked one of these things at street level, you realize how close some of those walls really are. And trying to imagine doing this, going down that same stretch of tarmac, you know, ridiculous speeds with 19 other guys wheel to wheel, makes you really appreciate what they do. So yeah, I always have a soft spot watching the race in Melbourne because I can go, oh, I've walked on that corner. I know exactly where that is.
That's great.
It was a good race. It was a good opening start to the season, and you know, I actually got to watch this year's race down at the Circuit of Americas. They actually have a watch party when they open up one of the VIP lounges when there's a Grand Prix on, and you can just basically go in and watch the Grand Prix for free on the big screens at the Circuit of Americas, which is very cool. And the cheer that went up with the couple of hundred people that were in the lounge watching it when Vettel took the lead was a joy to behold, because I think everybody wanted to see somebody other than a Mercedes out front. So
absolutely,
it was a good race. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, then we had China, and this was the revenge of Lewis Hamilton. He was able to get back on top. Vettel though finished second, so he didn't lose any ground. They were tied after that. We did have Verstappen manage to get into third ahead of Ricciardo and Raikkonen, and I'm trying to think and Bottas ended up down in sixth because he spun out behind the. This is when we spun out behind the safety car, if I recall correctly. So he didn't even make it on the podium for that race. That was just a week prior to Bahrain, so that one kind of run together for me. So, for me, that one was a lot of fun, even though Hamilton won, because you got to see Max in a car that kept going all the way to the end and did what I suspected he could do. So what stands out for you from China?
I think the interesting thing at China was it wasn't as wet as we thought it was going to be. I think everybody thought it was going to be a really, complete wet race, rain all the way through. And it ended up being that interesting, started sort of dampish,
mm-hmm.
and then dried out. Again, you know, the standout was Max Verstappen, coming 18th to finish. I mean, he got up to second at one point, but finishing third. A terrific drive. The thing that really caught my attention in China was the amount of overtaking. And very little of it, if any of it, was actually done using the drag reduction system, which is the sort of the gimmick thing that if you're within a second of a car on one of the long straights in a particular zone, you can actually open a flap on your back wing and it gives you, you know, like an extra 80 kilometers an hour and you can zoom past everybody. And hardly anybody actually made a pass using that DRS. Nearly every pass was made actually out on the twiddly bits of the circuit where people were actually going wheel to wheel. Some of the on-track battles were great. I mentioned earlier Vettel and Ricciardo literally banging wheels as they sort of went around the corners. So yeah, for me, the standout in China was obviously Verstappen, but also just the amount of on-track overtaking that took place, which really sort of seemed to disprove the nobody would be able to pass with these new cars concern that we all had over the winter. So yeah, very interesting race to watch.
It was fun. And then what was really fun, I thought, was the beginning of Bahrain. It gets to our last race here. Well, the beginning of the lap one of Bahrain, to me, was the best opening of a race. Well, now, if you don't like Mercedes, the best opening of a race would have to be Spain last year, where they committed they had a mutual suicide pact on lap one, right, where Nico and Hamilton, that will live forever in infamy as just like, good gosh. But in terms of really exciting racing, you had, on lap one, you had Bottas, Vettel, Hamilton, Verstappen, Ricciardo, and Massa all clumped together tight through the whole lap. Usually somebody takes off and leaves everybody else, or the first two take off and leave everybody else in the first lap, you know. It looked like a race through the first lap or two, and you're thinking, man, this is going to go, you know, this could be a fun race all the way through. Of course, then they have the safety car, the virtual safety car and all that, and it kind of messed things up a little bit. But that first lap was amazing. Did you get that impression?
Yeah, I think it was the first four or five were together for the first five or six laps. It was a really good start to the race. What particularly impressed me was actually the way that Bottas actually hung out in front once Vettel was behind him. I think that he showed there that he can fight, and you know, it looked good. But obviously he had the overinflated tire problem, and that sort of dropped him back. But I think it showed, you know, flashes of that he will be in there fighting for race wins at various points during the season. Probably not the championship, but I think he will be in there fighting for race wins, and it was a good indication of that. So yeah, a great race. And like we said, you know, even further down the field, you know, they were coming into some of the corners three abreast, which was crazy. But good to see it. There was good racing again up and down the field. So we've had three good races with action up and down the field. And then at the end, obviously, we had the nail biter, you know, Hamilton had to make up like whatever it was, 25 seconds, and he had X number of laps to do it. And if you did the math, in theory, he could take 2 seconds a lap, and he was starting to do that. And it was like, is he going to get there? Is he not going to do it? Is he on the right tires? So yeah, just at the end, watching Hamilton sort of reel in Vettel.
Yes.
I think even if it had caught up with him, I don't think he'd have passed him. I think, you know, there just wasn't enough race distance left to do that. But yeah, it was a really good race again up and down the field, and you know, some of the incidents and retirements just added to the drama of it. So.
Well, the drama at the end you're talking about. I have a few notes here that on lap 47, 48, as Hamilton was closing in on Bottas, the team radio said, "Lewis, you have the pace to win this." And what that meant was that Hamilton could catch up to Vettel, they thought. And he was gaining about 1.5 seconds, like you say, 1.5, 2 seconds a lap. But two things happened, and I want to get your opinion on this. Two things happened to Hamilton. One, of course, was the 5-second penalty. Without that, he might have been all over Vettel's rear bumper at the end. And knowing Lewis Hamilton, he might have. But the other thing was, did you notice he was gaining about 1.5 seconds on him until the last two laps? The last lap or so, he stopped gaining on him anymore, and I don't know if Hamilton just decided he wasn't going to catch him and backed off just to make sure he finished, or whether his tires were starting to go away or what. Did you get a sense of that Hamilton kind of had backed off at the very end?
Yeah, I did. I sort of thought he was basically settling for second position at that point. Yeah. And it may also have been the tires, because he did actually question the call. I mean, when he came out on the
right.
the softs as opposed to the super softs, he was like, "Are you sure you guys put me on the right tires?" Mm-hmm. And they were like, "Yeah, you know, we did it based on the data. You know, and math doesn't lie, so shut up and drive." I'm paraphrasing a bit there, but
right. No, it was pretty close to what they said.
So yeah, it may have been the tires had just started to go off, because he had actually been pushing them so hard. And if it had been on the super softs, they probably would have gone off earlier. So, you know, I think, given the choice, they probably did make the right strategic call, but I think within a couple of laps, he realized that he just wasn't going to catch him and be in a position to overtake him, because it's no good catching him on the last lap if you don't have, like, it usually takes three laps to line somebody up to overtake him. So
that's true.
Yeah.
Well, here's the current point standing after three races. We've got Russia coming up next, so we got Vladimir Putin gets to come out and hand somebody a trophy. How exciting. We've got Vettel sitting on 68, Hamilton 61, and the difference is just the difference between a first place and a second place finish right now. Then you've got Bottas actually in third, Raikkonen right behind him, so it's 38-34, Verstappen in fifth with 25, and Ricciardo right behind there at 22. So it's interesting. It's still competitive across 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 drivers, theoretically.
Yeah.
That's great.
In theory, yeah.
In theory, but yeah, that's pretty cool, I think. So.
Yeah. But I think in reality, we're looking at a two-horse race with Vettel and Hamilton, but I think it's going to be a really interesting race, and I think it's going to go down to the wire.
Should be fun. So Russia, and then we go to Spain, and we get new engines and stuff, and that'll be fun too. So, okay, last thing I want to touch on tonight is IndyCar, just really quickly. We've had two races. We had the opening one in St. Petersburg, Florida, and then we had the Toyota Grand Prix of Long Beach last weekend. They have another race Sunday at Barber Sports Park in Birmingham, Alabama, basically my hometown, more or less. I'm from Sylacauga. And it kills me that they have an IndyCar race right near my hometown now, when growing up, all we had was Talladega. Yeah, I know people are like, all you have was Talladega. My gosh, man. I'm like, yeah, I don't like NASCAR. I grew up 30 minutes from the Talladega track and couldn't have cared less. I went to one race ever in my life in Talladega, and I fell asleep. I thought it was the most boring thing ever. So I would have killed to have an IndyCar race in Alabama when I was a kid. So in the first race, I believe it was one of our French guys, right? Was it Sébastien Bourdais?
Sébastien Bourdais, yes.
Yeah. And kind of a surprise there. He'd gotten back with his old team, and the Honda's engine surprised everybody, and it was kind of an interesting race.
Yeah, that was an issue. I mean, he came from the back, and they played it strategically well. It's great to see him back up the front. I'm a big fan of his. I loved watching him in the old Champ Car days, when he was winning multiple championships in the old Champ Car days. And of course, he's another guy who spent some time in F1 and then came back to IndyCar. So yeah, it's good to see him and the team back at the front and playing a very good strategic race with it was Delcoin Racing he drives for, who are just based actually just outside of Chicago, not far from where you're going to be at the weekend.
Oh yeah. How did I'm trying to think who ended up winning the it kind of faded out of my mind as soon as I watched it, the second race, the Long Beach
was James Hinchcliffe.
Wasn't it? That's right. The Canadian guy. That's right. Yeah. Right. So the two of them are at the top, obviously, because they've each won a race. The only thing I want to ask you about this, and we'll get more into IndyCar as our season goes along, but there's only been two races, and it hasn't been quite as scintillating as IndyCar as if Formula One. But the drivers for IndyCar, right? These guys, I mean, some of them obviously really are talented drivers. You got guys like Tony Kanaan and Elio Castroneves and all them. But by and large, how do you rate the IndyCar drivers stacked up against the Formula One drivers? Like a guy like a Scott Dixon the other French guy that's so good, Pagano, right? I mean, how do you rate these guys stacked up against the others, against Formula One?
That's an interesting question. I don't think any with the obvious exception of Mario Andretti, I don't think any IndyCar driver has ever really got to the forefront of Formula One. I mean, they're very different disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
Tend to find that most F1 drivers, middle to lower end F1 drivers who come to IndyCar do really well.
Mm.
I think the big difference is the ovals. I think you either, you know, you can
right.
tackle the ovals or you can't. I think anybody that drives an oval, again, is really special. I'm going to sound like I'm boasting here again, but I was actually lucky enough to do a performance driving school at Indianapolis a couple of years ago. And we actually drove and raced on the infield circuit. So you use part of the banking.
Mm-hmm.
And then the infield circuit. But at the end of the day, our tutors were actually IndyCar drivers. At the end of the day, they actually took us around the full oval. You got driven around the full oval by an IndyCar driver.
Wow,
In a sports car. I had Pippa Mann drove me around. I'll tell you, anybody that drives, I mean, we were doing probably 160, I think, tops in the sports car. Anybody that's driving
all?
Around there at 220, yeah, because that place, every little bump and change in the circuit, you can feel it. So, I think folks who drive on ovals are pretty special, and I think that's the big difference in the IndyCar guys. Yeah, you have a few road circuit specialists. Again, a lot of the guys who sort of either come over from Europe. For me, I think the one IndyCar driver who could have really done, or the two IndyCar drivers who really could have done something in Formula One if circumstances had been different, was probably Dan Weldon and Dario Franchitti. And I'm not saying that just because they were both British, I think they had the skills to do stuff in F1. I think they both could have had F1 careers if things had been different.
Mm-hmm.
So they always say that F1 is the best drivers in the world. I would rank them slightly higher than the IndyCar drivers. But having said that, I have great respect for the IndyCar drivers, just for the different types of circuits they do, the different, and not just ovals, but ovals and, you know, different sizes from sort of the short ovals to the, you know, the monster 2.5 miles at Indy. Along with street circuits and road courses, I think it tackles a lot more disciplines than F1. So again, I think it sort of, you need a different breed of driver to do that. So huge respect for them down the field.
That Iowa race last year looked like just being in a centrifuge. They're just going round and round and round and round, and I'm just like, it's giving me a headache to watch it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's amazing. So yeah, it is a diverse set. That is one thing I like about IndyCar. You get such a diverse set of tracks. I mean, I know the Formula One tracks are all different, but in a lot of ways, they're kind of the same. They're the same in how they're different. Whereas IndyCar really are, there are different tracks, just different tracks completely.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, go ahead.
I was going to say you mentioned the IndyCar design earlier on the top of the.
Oh yeah,
the
yeah, yeah.
I'm with you. I don't particularly like the current design. I mean, unfortunately, the current design came out of the safety stuff after Dan Weldon's unfortunate accident a few years back.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can see it from that point of view, but I don't know if you've seen the sketches of the 2018 car, where they're actually making it sleeker and taking some of the extra baggage off it, and actually it looks really good.
It just doesn't even almost look like an open-wheel car anymore. They got so much plastic around it.
But the 2018 one looks more like a retro sleek racing car.
If you haven't
seen it, I'd go online and try and Google the images for the rendering of the 2018 IndyCar. It looks good.
What I saw was just sort of an outline of it compared to the current one, and I couldn't tell enough difference just from an outline. But I'd like to see like the actual rendering. The thing is, I thought back in the 70s, like in the Johnny Rutherford and Gordon Johncock, you know, AJ Foyt, that period, I thought that the Indy cars back then looked better than Formula One cars, and now it's the other way around completely, and that's disappointing to me because they have that potential to be so awesome looking, and they just kind of look like. They look like almost like toys. I'm just not thrilled with it. So, but who do you see coming out?
Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, so who do you see coming out of this season? Is Bourdais going to keep rolling? Is Pagenaud going to get back on top? Or is one of the guys, like one of the old guys like Castroneves or Dixon, still got a race left in him? And what's going to happen to Marco Andretti, for crying out loud?
I'd love to see Bourdais keep it going. I don't know if, I mean, it's a small team. I don't know whether they can keep it going. The tactics and the strategy for the two street circuits they've run so far is going to be very different than when they get onto the road courses and the big ovals. So I'd be surprised if Bourdais stays at the top. I would love to see him do it. I'd like to see Hinchcliffe maybe lift the championship. I think he could do it. I have a soft spot for him after his big accident at Indy and then him coming back a year later and taking the pole at the Indy 500. Yeah. I thought that was an amazing feat of. But you can't rule out the old guard like Scott Dixon. He's always there. I must admit, Pagenaud, who won last year, I really don't think any feel much about him one way or the other. I was like, he was one of the guys that he won, and I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Actually, my favorite in IndyCar was and F1 and NASCAR was Montoya. I used to love Montoya. I mean, he was win or crash, but he was fun to watch. So I'm sort of missing that he's not going to be in the full season this year. Interesting to see where things stake out. I really don't shake out. I don't really have a particular person I'm sort of planting my flag with this year in IndyCar. I'm just interested to see how this sort of new guard sort of shakes out. So,
well.
As for Marco Andretti, I don't think he has the talent of his father, never mind his grandfather. I think it seems to be a law of diminishing returns as they go through the generations there. I think he'll stick it out probably a few more seasons, and then, I don't know, they'll go off into the family business or something. I think they need to stick somebody else in that car. But, at one point I thought he'd be great. I mean, that year he almost won at Indy, and Sam Hornish pitched him at the line. I screamed at the TV at that point because I wanted Marco to win, but I'm not really following him these days at all. So,
I rooted for his grandfather back when I was a kid quite a bit, and I'll never forget the Indy race where Mario just was leaving everybody behind, and then on the next to last lap or whatever, his engine blew up.
Yeah.
Oh, he was so far ahead of everybody in that black. I mean, we had a black car, and he was so far ahead, and then it just went out. And I think that was a year maybe one of the Unsers caught up with him. But so I just root for that family. But I'm not thrilled having the two French guys and the Canadian guy up at the top of the Indy car. That's my main thing. I don't mind an Australian or New Zealand guy like Dixon and or even Ryan. I'd like to see Ryan Hunter-Reay, and I really like, I really enjoy the personality of Kanaan and Castroneves. They're just fun. They just seem like, because what IndyCar needs to me is more personality. The Formula One guys all have personality, and it's fun to see their rivalries and all that. The IndyCar guys all just seem kind of blandly nice. And it
really. I think Hinchcliffe's got tons of personality, but
I haven't seen enough of him. That's just it. See, I haven't seen enough of him. I'll keep paying attention and try to catch that then, because all I ever see is just these guys saying the same things and doing the same things. Nobody's throwing a hat at anybody or throwing a steering wheel at anybody or anything like Nico and Lewis last year. Maybe I got spoiled by that last year, but that's just, I just want to see a little more interesting gamesmanship among them, maybe, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, any last thoughts about IndyCar before we wrap up our open wheel for tonight?
No, I'd say I'm looking forward to Barber this weekend. Like we said, I did hear a rumor that Alonso may be in the pit, so it'll be interesting to see if he is and if the TV picked that up, and be interested to see if we catch any thoughts on his first exposure to IndyCar. I'd be interested to see the first road race, see how things blackout for that. I would actually I'd like to see Graham Rahal win one. I think he's actually good on the road courses, and if you want to put an American out top, I'd rather put Graham Rahal as the guy up front. I looking forward to that Indy, and of course looking forward to May at the Brickyard. Even though I won't be there this year, it'll be great to. We'll certainly be settling down to watch that one. So.
And my family, we will be at the Granite City Race, the Gateway, up at Gateway Park. I can't think what it's actually. It's calling it Madison, Illinois, or something crazy, but it's in Granite City, and it's just about a half an hour north of where I live. So I'm very excited that there will be a race right here, an IndyCar race. Now, my daughter, of course, who's 9, is now a big Formula One fan, big Lewis Hamilton fan, and she wants to go to Circuit of the Americas. So maybe one of these years we'll get down to Austin and hook up with you. But for this year, we're going to settle for Granite City, Illinois. Woo!
Well, we just ordered our tickets for Circuit of the Americas for October. So.
What does a ticket go for on average at that track? I'm just trying to imagine.
Actually, for what we like to do is actually we don't go in the grandstands. We just get a general admission ticket.
Mm-hmm.
That means you can walk around and pick your spot. For the 3 days, it's $159.
Okay.
General admission.
The Granite City is going to cost us about $50 a piece.
Yeah.
up in the grandstands, right near the start finish line. So that's the difference between Formula One and IndyCar,
IndyCar,
there.
Yeah. But Indianapolis last year was not that cheap. I mean, Indianapolis last year I think was around $100 a ticket.
Yeah.
So and that was like turn four. Mm-hmm. So you get what you pay for, I guess. But
exactly.
We always enjoy just to like I say, Coda, just to get the general admission ticket and pick our spot and move around. We'll sit in different places for practice and qualifying, and then we sort of stake out a spot for the race, and we have a great time.
There you go. Well, we're going to get to Indy one of these days. We're going to get to Circuit of the Americas one of these days, but we're going to settle for Granite City, Illinois this year.
I used to drive past Granite City Raceway quite regularly when we used to live up that way, and never actually got to a race there. I'm a little envious of that. I wouldn't have minded seeing a race there.
It'll be neat. Okay, well, thanks so much, Alan. It was really great. I've enjoyed having you on, and hopefully we've covered everything to everybody's satisfaction. We're going to wrap it up for tonight and get this show loaded up. We will be back. We will reconvene at some point that you and I mutually agree on down the road a little bit to, no pun intended, to see how the season is stacking up at that point. Sound good?
That sounds great. It's been great fun being on the podcast with you and talking F1 and IndyCar, and really enjoyed it and looking forward to doing it again, as you said, at some other point in the season as things progress.
Absolutely. All right. We'll see you guys down the road.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.